This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Scott Simon, and each night we're here to answer your questions.
Hi, my name is April Wilson, and I am in Salt Lake City, Utah.
This is Allison Cohen.
My name is Marshall.
Srinivas Pendiala from Houston, Texas.
I've just got questions about how to safely shop when you're at the grocery store.
Is there going to be a national mandate for masks and PPE?
If I got COVID-19, could I pass it on to my cats?
I just feel that I've been put in a situation where I'm not actually taken care of as an employee.
Could you please elaborate on this topic?
Thank you so much.
NPR journalists and outside experts are on hand to offer you facts, to tell you what we know and correct some of the misinformation floating around. And when we don't know something, we'll tell you that, too. You can send us your questions about the pandemic and the way we live now at npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, you can use the hashtag NPR Conversation. Each night, we begin the National Conversation by answering the question, what happened today? The International Monetary Fund's chief economist, Geeta Gopinath, warned that this could be the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
We are projecting global growth in 2020 to fall to -3%.
And that could mean a loss of $9 trillion. President Trump announced the U.S. would stop funding to the World Health Organization while they review its coronavirus response. The president also reversed course and said he would work with governors to get the country up and running.
And what I do is going to be done in conjunction with governors.
Yesterday, Mr. Trump said he could override governors and reopen the country. Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, told NPR she'll work with whoever is in the White House.
Remember that the enemy is COVID-19. It's not one another.
Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker told NPR they need more from the federal government as cases rise.
The truth is that the federal government has really been more of a hindrance than a help in most of the testing issues.
New York City's mayor, Bill de Blasio, said that social distancing could continue into the summer as the state struggles with testing.
I vividly remember when my kids were teenagers. It would have been really tough to say to them that you got a whole summer ahead and you still have to practice social distancing and you still have to stay in a lot, but that could well be the case.
We start today by looking at the situation of essential workers. We know and depend on them. Grocery store clerks, gas station attendants, nurses, postal workers, police officers, and so many others. We've received a number of questions from essential workers and their loved ones. We're going to bring in now Shannon Liss Reardon for some answers. She's an employment lawyer based in Boston and currently has emergency motions filed against Uber and Lyft over their sick pay policies relating to COVID-19. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've got two questions about how postal workers are not being provided proper protection in the workplace. This is the first from Steve in Minnesota.
I work for UPS. I work in what's called the sort aisle. Basically, it's about a 2-foot aisle, and we're subjected to stand next to each other, basically shoulder to shoulder. There's no PPE provided, and we're also not provided with any kind of hazard pay. I was just wondering how we can get UPS to be held accountable to the standards that other businesses are being held to.
And let's hear next from Harold in Albany, Georgia.
UPS and FedEx aren't providing protective equipment to their associates. So if one of them became sick or died from it, would they be held liable for it?
And, let me turn to you. What's your immediate answer?
Sure. So first of all, let me just say, I'm going to give some general guidance based on these questions. Of course, this shouldn't be considered legal advice because that would require more detailed discussion and consultation. But generally speaking, for Steve in Minnesota, if your employer is not taking the protective measures that they should be taking, for instance, if you are an essential worker and you are still able to work, if it's possible in your workplace to be at least 6 feet away from everyone, that's what should be happening in your workplace. There should be protective gear that would protect you. If you don't feel that you're getting the protections that you should get, first of all, you should let your employer know. I always suggest that be done in writing, not just orally. So send an email to your boss so that you have a written record. If the situation is not taken care of, you can file an OSHA complaint, and OSHA has set up a website you can do a complaint right on their website. And if you do that, you should do it quickly because it has to be done within 30 days. And if you make that kind of complaint to OSHA, you're protected from retaliation. If you're a member of a labor union, you should definitely talk to your union to see what they can do and whether there's any activity that they're planning or could plan. And even if you're not a member of a labor union, you are protected if you join together with your coworkers to complain about or organize in any way to protest an employer not making your workplace safe. And you'd be protected under the National Labor Relations Act from any retaliation for bringing those concerns to your employer. So I would definitely recommend those considerations.
Me ask, though, should you report for work?
Well, so that is a big question that a lot of people are struggling with right now. If you are being required or asked to work in a situation that you don't feel is safe, then no, you shouldn't. And I think there would be a good argument that your employer should still continue to pay you. You shouldn't be let go if you are ready and able to work, but you're not being provided with a workplace. If your employer could make the workplace safe and you're not being provided with that safe workplace, I think you've got an argument that you should continue to get paid. You can also have a conversation with your employer about what their paid sick leave plan is and make use of that. You may also qualify under your state law for paid sick leave, and you might be eligible under the new federal legislation for enhanced sick pay, family leave. If, for instance, if you have a child whose school has been closed or whose daycare has been closed, and worst case scenario, there is unemployment, and there's been expanded unemployment under the recent federal legislation, which makes a lot more workers eligible, even if you wouldn't have been eligible before the pandemic. If you aren't going to work and it's tied in some way to the pandemic, you're probably going to be eligible to collect unemployment.
And what about Harold's question? If God forbid, someone became sick and died, would their employer be liable for it?
So if an employee is injured or harmed at work, or if, God forbid, an employee dies at work, the employer would be liable under workers' comp. So an employee who's affected by an unsafe workplace can have a workers' comp claim. If a worker dies, their loved ones can file a workers' comp claim for death. So it's not like you go into court and file a usual wrongful death case. It would follow the workers' comp rules. You'd have to file for workers' comp under your state policy, but the employer would ultimately be held liable that way.
Workers' comp, but not a criminal penalty, is what you're suggesting.
Well, that may be up to state authorities. Mm-hmm. But from a worker's perspective, the remedy is a workers' comp claim.
Let's move to another question, if we could, from Sonia in New Hampshire.
My truck driver husband has Crohn's disease, an autoimmune disease. He is active and eats organically. He's concerned about his health at his job. He's trying to do what he can, but he is scared. What is being done by our government to help our most vulnerable workers?
Shannon?
So, it sounds like your husband he has a pre-existing medical condition which might make him more susceptible to a negative reaction to the coronavirus, so he might be more vulnerable. So workers who are more susceptible to it, in particular, if they're working for employers who haven't closed because they're essential workers, but they still don't feel safe going to work, again, like I just said, they may have a conversation with the employer about whether or not they can take paid sick leave under the employer's policy. Congress just passed in March, on March 18th, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which expands sick pay. It's really far from perfect, but it expands it on a national level. Exempts employers that have more than 500 employees, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's a compromise that Congress came to. And also small employers who have less than 50 employees are able to get an exemption from it. And it looks like the Labor Department just put out guidelines that it's making it pretty easy for small employers to get out of it. So that is a pretty limited protection, but it is something. And again, there's unemployment. A lot more people are going to be eligible now to collect unemployment than would have been before. And your husband may be eligible to collect unemployment, even if the workplace is still open, if there's a particular reason, reasonable reason, for him to feel he can't go to work because of the pandemic.
In the minute we have left, Shannon, if somebody who was considered, I hear theme music, so it seems to me I've, if you have a question for Shannon Liss Reardon, you can send it to us at npr.org. If somebody's in a non-essential business and their employer says you've got to show up anyway, can they say no?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. I think if your employer is breaking the rules, for one thing, you can contact state authorities or local authorities. Some of them have said they're going to enforce these stay-at-home orders with a fine for businesses that don't comply. If you inform your employer that you don't feel it's appropriate for you to go to work because this violates a rule, again, I would recommend put it in writing.
Shannon Liss Reardon, thank you so much for joining us. You can hear more of our extensive coverage when you download the NPR One app. Up next, a labor... This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from it. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Scott Simon. Every day we get a lot of questions about the virus, its properties, the way it spreads, how we can better protect ourselves. Here to try and answer some of your questions is NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent, Jason Bobie. And Jason, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
And before we get into some of those questions, President Trump made a surprising announcement tonight.
Today I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus.
Now, of course, Jason, the Trump administration's response to the virus has been widely criticized for mismanagement. What reasoning was provided behind this cut?
Well, President Trump, you know, he just had very strong words of criticism that he's now throwing at the World Health Organization. He accused them of covering up the outbreak in China, of parroting misinformation from Beijing, of, as you had in that clip, him saying they were severely mismanaging the crisis and failing to inform member states of the extent of the problem. He basically put a lot of the blame for this global crisis on the WHO. He said that if the WHO had done its job effectively, the outbreak could have been contained at its source in China. You know, I think most epidemiologists would disagree with him on that. Viruses don't respect borders. The WHO has been warning about the danger this virus poses globally for months. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said tonight that what Trump was doing in the midst of the worst pandemic in a century makes about as much sense as cutting off ammunition to an ally as the enemy closes in. But the president says the funds are suspended and his administration is going to review the relationship the U.S. has with the WHO.
Let me ask you about contact tracing, because that's one of the things that many people say has to happen for the country, all countries, to go back to some degree of normal everyday life. Yeah. What's the use of contact tracing?
So contact tracing is about trying to hone in on where exactly the virus is. And this doesn't work. It wouldn't work in New York right at the moment when you've got this huge explosion of cases going on. But in the early days, when you get only some clusters of cases, and in the later days, when you start getting down to having very few cases, being able to find out exactly where the virus is, who's infected, who may have been infected, and basically put this buffer around those cases and around the virus itself. So this idea is that if you can find out who possibly was infected, because you know who actually is, trace those people, track them down, monitor them. If they don't get infected, then you know you have broken the chain of transmission. So it's this way of trying to just hone straight into where the virus is and cut off any additional transmission to other people.
So let me understand. Somebody who was diagnosed says, well, I talked to this person, I met this person, I shook hands with this person, I had dinner with that person, and they trace them, right?
Right. And so they would assess, well, did you just talk to them across the counter? Was it 6 feet away? Or was it someone you actually sat down and had dinner with? So they would analyze whether or not this seems like there was the possibility for transmission. If there was, they would go to that other person, talk to them, see if they have symptoms. If they do, get them tested. If not, monitor them. Monitor them probably every day. And the places that do this really well, they're checking in either electronically or in person every day with those people and warning them. Usually those people will be told to self-quarantine for 14 days if they can, because they are now at risk of actually developing the disease. And so it's this way of really making sure that once you know one person is infected, the other people who may have been infected by that person, trace them down, get in contact with them, monitor them closely, and keep it from spreading any further.
This question from Hope in Los Angeles.
I want to know if there are any civil rights concerns or privacy concerns that would arise with the widespread use of contact tracking after individuals were to test positive for COVID-19. And if voluntary waivers or something along those lines could alleviate any legal barriers?
That's a big question. What's happened in other countries?
It's a very interesting question. And so let me just talk about Singapore. Singapore was highly praised. It was a place that very aggressively did contact tracing. And they actually used the police force to track people down. The police are quite good at this. This is what they do, right? They find somebody. They're like, who did you have contact with? And they go and they find the other people. They also were publishing not the names of who was actually testing positive, but if it was at a particular church, they would disclose that it was at this church, that this business had a cluster of cases. Other countries have been much more open about who it is that has tested positive, about not worrying so much about, yes, some of the civil rights issues that we would be concerned with oftentimes in this country. And Singapore has basically taken this approach that getting ahead of this outbreak, getting ahead of this disease is more important than somebody's privacy or some civil rights. And that has been the approach. And yes, in this day and age, when you can actually track somebody's movement by their cell phone, and governments potentially could do that, there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about what might happen. And some places are choosing to actually use those technologies to do that. So it's definitely something that needs to be weighed. What is the amount of privacy we're willing to give up, and how important is it to get this epidemic under control?
Jason, we have a question from one of our younger listeners. 10-year-old Liam in Maryland.
I'm Liam Slattery. Is there going to be a national mandate for masks and PPE?
By the way, Liam, thanks for listening. Hope you heard yourself tonight. Jason?
That's a great question, Liam. I doubt that you're going to see a national mandate on this. Masks have actually traditionally been banned in a lot of states. Masks have been a state issue prior to this outbreak.
We should explain banned because people rob banks wearing masks. And that's
right. And so there are some places where you're just not allowed to wear a mask in public. And now you actually have some states requiring people to be wearing masks in public. Actually, tomorrow, Maryland is going to mandate that people who are going into shops have to be wearing masks. L.A. has a mandate like that. So does Miami Beach. The CDC last week issued national guidelines recommending wearing face coverings in public for all Americans. But like I said, this has really been a local issue and a state's issue, and it's probably likely to remain that way.
So municipalities will choose on their own rather than there be any kind of national policy.
Yes. There's a national policy from the CDC recommending this, but I think we're only going to get it mandated probably from local levels. And I think that's what you can expect to see, just like some of the stay-at-home orders. That's really being run by the states. It's unlikely that the national government is going to step in on this.
NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent Jason Beaubien, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You're listening to The National Conversation with All Things Considered. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Scott Simon. Lockdown measures are in place over much of the country, so one of the few places many Americans go these days is the grocery store. Some cities now require masks and social distancing in grocery stores. But what are the best ways to stay safe when shopping in the aisles and bringing home groceries? We're joined now by NPR science editor Maria Godoy and Donald Schaffner, who's a professor of food microbiology at Rutgers. Welcome to you both. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
Lots of questions, so let's begin. Elizabeth in West Haven, Connecticut, wants to know if she should go to the grocery store or should it be her husband?
We are trying to decide which one of us should go to the grocery store. I think that I should go because my immune system is better. But since we're living in the same house, we're assuming that if he got it, I would get it, and vice versa. So which one of us should go to the grocery store? Thanks.
Boy, Maria, advice doesn't get any more personal than this. What do you advise?
Ooh, Scott. Well, if someone at home is at higher risk for developing severe disease with COVID-19, the best option would be to get groceries delivered. Or, you know, maybe ask a friend or neighbor to get groceries for them, if that's at all possible. If that's not an option, it gets kind of tricky because unless people are isolating from each other at home, it would be hard to keep one from getting infected if the other person is sick. But it's not impossible to prevent that infection, especially if the person who gets sick shows symptoms quickly and can be isolated quickly. But the bigger risk is still probably to the person who goes shopping. But really, I would urge them to ask a friend or to get a delivery service to drop off groceries.
Well, that sets up our next question about deliveries, alternatives to going to the store.
My name is Heather Lancaster, and I live in Traverse City, Michigan. And I was wondering how safe it is to get food services like HelloFresh and Blue Apron.
Professor Schaffner, millions of Americans are using those such services. Are they set? Are they safe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those services represent a good alternative, especially if the individual in question is potentially at risk, immunocompromised or diabetic or otherwise. Those delivery services do represent a reduction in risk because you don't have to go to the grocery store. Going to the grocery store is actually the biggest risk that you face when acquiring food. So, yeah, I think that they're definitely a good alternative.
And by the way, if you have a question for Professor Schaffner or Maria Godoy about groceries, you can send it to us at npr.org/nationalconversation. A couple of questions now about how safe it is to actually eat grocery store goods. This is from Marty in Brookline, Massachusetts.
I have heard that you can clean vegetables like lettuce with diluted hydrogen peroxide. And I'm wondering if that's true and if it's necessary.
Hi, this is Srinivas Pendiala from Houston, Texas. If we buy bakery food such as muffins or bread from stores like Costco or Walmart, will there be any chance of virus transmission through this food? Could you please elaborate on this topic?
Yes, Professor, please elaborate.
Well, so first let me say that the risks of not eating still outweigh the risks of eating. So everybody should continue to eat food.
You mean hunger, yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, okay.
And we know that there is no evidence currently that the COVID-19 is spread via food or by food contact surfaces or food packaging, and so there doesn't seem to be a risk there. Definitely not a good idea to use hydrogen peroxide or other cleaning wipes that are designed for hard surfaces on things like fresh produce. My advice for fresh produce is simply wash it with cold water. If it's something like a melon or a harder a product, you can scrub that down with a vegetable brush. But other than that, I don't recommend anything else on fresh produce.
Let me get back to the grocery store because it's one of the hardest places. People do not traditionally maintain social distancing in a grocery store. Ricardo of Anchorage, Alaska wants some advice.
I've just got questions about how to safely shop when you're at the grocery store. What are things you can be doing at the store to keep yourself safe and those around you who are safe?
Yeah, Maria, I mean, you can see people lined up at safe distances outside of grocery stores, but in the aisle, that's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is difficult. But actually, that line outside the store is a good sign because if they're limiting the number of customers that go inside the store, It's going to make it easier to maintain social distance inside the store. Also, you should try going during off hours if at all possible, so it's less likely to be crowded. And go alone so you don't, you know, add to the crowding. Once you're in there, one of the things to do, of course, is disinfect the handles on your cart. A lot of stores are doing this for you already, but bring your own wipes if you can. Don't touch your face while you're in the store and wear a face covering. And go prepared. And this is actually a tip I got from my fellow panelist, Don Schaffner, which is take a list with you when you go to the store. And, you know, maybe also just go to a store where you already know the layout, so you know where to find what you need. And you can move quickly through the aisles while still being respectful of your fellow shoppers. And if you happen to be in an aisle that's crowded, maybe double back later to get what you need so you're not adding to that crowd. And the other thing is at checkout, you opt for the option where you're more likely to be able to maintain that 6-foot distance. So whether that's a cash register or self-checkout is really going to depend on the store's layout. But the, you know, last tip is really to disinfect your hands when you leave the store and again when you get home.
Important question now about the people who actually work in those stores.
My name is Jenny Wilson, and I live in San Francisco, California. My 19-year-old son still is working at a grocery store, and I'm wondering what precautions I can take to protect myself and the rest of our family who are living with him.
Maria?
Well, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration has issued guidelines for retailers to help protect their employees, though things like, you know, installing plexiglass screens at cash registers or letting their workers wear masks or giving them hand sanitizer. But in terms of protecting the grocery worker at home, I think changing his clothes as soon as he gets home, washing his hands and face, or taking a shower are all good precautions to take. It's actually also would be good for that son to try to maintain social distance from the rest of the family at home as much as possible. And of course, everyone, not just in that home, but just everyone in general, should be washing their hands frequently. It might also be a good idea for the caller's son to take his temperature first thing in the morning and again at night to watch for signs of fever. And if there is someone at home who is at greater risk for developing severe COVID-19, like let's say an elderly relative, it would actually also be good to check in with that person's healthcare provider if there are other precautions the family should be taking.
What about clothes that her son is wearing?
Well, I mean, again, as Don mentioned, the primary source of infection isn't clothing, but just to because that son is coming into contact presumably with lots of people each day, he should be changing his clothes. Yeah, and just laundering them, throw them in the laundry.
Okay, we need to take a short break. Please stay with us. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. We're here with NPR's Maria Godoy and food microbiology expert Don Schaffner talking about your question about food safety and groceries. Another question about what happens after you get the groceries home from Allison.
Hi, this is Allison Cohen from Evanston, Illinois. My question is related to how refrigeration and freezers affect the virus. For example, if I pull a boxed frozen item out of the freezer that had originally been contaminated, would the freezer preserve the virus, or would it naturally dissipate at the same rate as room temperature?
Professor, does freezing, refrigeration affect the virus?
Well, Scott, it's like the old joke. I've got good news and bad news. The bad news is that cold temperatures preserve the virus. So refrigeration preserves it and freezing preserves it more. The good news is, again, no evidence that we have transmission from food or from food packaging at this point. If after you take that food out of the freezer and you prepare it, if you're still concerned before you sit down to eat, was a good idea before the pandemic, will be a good idea after and during as well, wash your hands before you sit down to eat.
Another question we got about is the safety of the food and how it gets into the store. Let's hear this question.
My name is Holly Honeycutt, and I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina. And I was talking with my daughter-in-law the other day, and we had heard different stories about farmers tossing milk and other farmers not picking products. But we turn around and go to a grocery store and we are limited in what we can buy, you know, two milks or two this or that. And we're wondering how come they couldn't figure out a new, or somebody couldn't figure out a new supply chain to get these things to the grocery store.
Maria, can you help us with this?
Yeah, so I think the problem she's talking about here is that a lot of the food farmers are tossing out right now is stuff they would have sold to places like restaurant chains or, like, you know, for school meals. And so this is food they sell in giant bulk sizes. It's not the portions you could buy at the grocery store. And in order to be able to divert these foods to grocery stores, you'd really have to send it to specific plants that package it in grocery store sizes. And those plants are already busy meeting existing demand. You could revamp existing plants to do that, but that would take time and a lot of money. But there are some people on an individual level that are trying to work around this. Like, for example, some restaurants are now selling the flour they get in big 50-pound sacks and, you know, reapportioning it and then selling those smaller portions to their customers. There are also, like, vegetable distributors trying to match farmers with food banks willing to pay the farmers so they can harvest their crops and then that food can go to the needy. But there's no real system-wide effort that I'm aware of.
Listener in Florida asked, should I give up meat to reduce heart disease risk and chances of survival if I get the virus? Professor Schaffner?
That's a really good question. I think that anything that anybody can do right now to try to be more healthy is a great idea. Hopefully, any benefit that listener would get from reducing their meat consumption would be realized after we're through this pandemic. But I encourage everybody to try to be as healthy as they can.
I'm going to chance a quick question. Lots of people bring reusable bags. Should that stop for the moment, Maria?
So there haven't actually been studies on reusable bags, but none of the experts I've spoken with see reusable bags as a particular concern, although some stores are banning them. If you do use them, just wash it or, you know, disinfect it after each use.
Thanks very much. If you have questions, you can send them to us at npr.org/nationalconversation. The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Scott Simon. When the stay-at-home orders started, many of us had to dramatically change our daily lives. One of our callers had to mobilize not only for people, but for animals. Johanna Humbert is executive director at the Humane Society in Indiana, where they've seen a huge demand.
Some people wanted an easy pet they could just relax with. Some people were willing to take a more challenging animal that was going to need some training.
And she says the support she's seeing now has been like nothing she's ever seen.
We normally have 5 or 10 animals in foster homes at any given point in time. When the stay-at-home order came down, we were able to move about 65 animals into foster homes in about a week.
You've sent us so many questions about pets and the coronavirus. Veterinarian Krista Miller is here. She's a veterinarian at Thrive Affordable Vet Care in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Dr. Miller, it must be. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's get right to the questions. One from April in Salt Lake City.
Many shelters have been looking for fosters and adopters, but is there a risk of contracting COVID-19 from adopted or fostered animals that may have been in contact with someone who is carrying the disease?
A sound question, because this disease, of course, was first transmitted from animals to humans. What have you seen?
So based off the results, even in the beginning transmission where there was a possible indication of transmission from animal to human, there was now a concern of whether or not it went from animal to human, and there was just some sort of mutation that now caused it to be primarily person to person. So just like any other aspect of the disease transmission process that we're being trained on as veterinarians, as people with the stay-at-home order, is going to just be profound enough that you wash your hands and follow the normal precautions of every day. But there is not a risk at this time or any concern about people adopting pets and having a transmission of COVID-19.
Okay. Next question from, I think the name is Ari in the District of Columbia.
My husband and I are in the process of adopting a dog. We are both working from home right now, which is great. And my question is, what can we do to gradually prepare the dog for the future when we're both going to be working at the office most of the day?
Of course, our own Ari Shapiro, but a valid question nonetheless. A lot of people we know are thinking about adopting a pet. What should Ari and his husband know?
So one of the best things to do is to consider the age of pet you're adopting. A lot of times with puppies, crate training is a great thing to do if you're going to be away for work once you start back later in life. So crate training is can have a great positive experience of getting a pet used to their crate and it becoming a happy place, a positive reinforcement, not a place where you send me when I do bad things. So when you're away, they learn that that's their place of comfort, their place at home, and they're used to being there. Even in addition to that, considering adding an item of clothing, something you worn that night or that day, added to their crate or their space, it kind of gives them a sense of comfort and will help them to adjust to the change. However, pets can develop separation anxiety when things change, but just like any other person or pet, it just takes some time.
Another question for veterinarian Krista Miller, this from Marshall in Charlottesville, Virginia.
So I have a dog, and I was wondering, based on the case in New York City with the tiger at the zoo that had very similar symptoms as humans do with COVID, is this a concern that we should have in the future? And how should we deal with this instance of disease being prevalent in more than one species?
A very good question. What do we know about diseases that go from species to species?
So at this time, there's not a huge concern regarding that. When you look into the article closely about the tiger, you'll find that the zookeeper was once infected with COVID-19. A lot of times with animals, in the case of the tiger, when he was exposed, they found the articles that are the things that could have been present to say that he was exposed. But there is not a huge concern in species-to-species jump. At this time, it's still being explored, still being studied. So at this point, definitely not a concern.
Another question to raise with you, Doctor. We have a question from April in Salt Lake City, Utah.
So I have heard that in response to economic decline due to COVID-19, many pet owners are giving up their animals or abandoning them. Is this true?
What have you seen, Doctor?
So there are instances where that is happening, but the biggest thing is being educated about the virus itself. There is not a reason a homeowner or a pet owner should be giving up their pet because of the COVID-19. If anything, there's only concern when a person is already infected and super ill, so you're more concerned about immune system and other diseases animals may carry, but not COVID-19.
And we know your state has been hit very hard by the virus. A lot of people have found it difficult to care for animals and or their owners all at the same time.
So ironically, where I actually work, I found an increase in the number of visits that I've seen here over the past few months. And I think it's just genuine concern for people and their pets, whether it's sneezing and coughing. And I think a lot of people are on a kind of panic mode and forgetting that it's also allergy season. So most of these pets are coming in for allergy issues with coughing and sneezing and things like that. So the biggest thing for owners to remember is we have to test for other diseases first, because COVID-19 will not be the first thing that we even think about. There are a lot of steps to take to confirm that. And most of the time, we just approach it from a normal standpoint of allergy season.
And veterinarians' offices are open, aren't they? They're part of what makes this country, they're essential business in this country, aren't
they? Yes, we definitely are essential because we help to prevent any other animal diseases that are zoonotic that could potentially spread from animals to humans, because they get a lot of things that we know that are zoonotic, so we try to prevent that as much as we can.
We are very grateful they're open. I don't mind saying our family and I had to take our beloved dog to the vet, but that's because she ate a cupcake.
Oh, wow. They do love those cupcakes.
And it had chocolate in it, but we were grateful. Apparently only a trace amount of chocolate. So Krista Miller, she is a veterinarian at Thrive Affordable Vet Care in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Dr. Miller, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for joining
You're
us
welcome.
Tonight
thank
on the
you.
National Conversation. I've heard a lot of data and statistics during this pandemic. Among the least surprising findings is that pet adoptions are on the rise. Some shelters are even close to empty. In times of stress, people turn to fur, tails, soft noses, and big eyes. Pets can be our companions, our confidants, our fellow travelers, and best audiences. They can make us go outside, they take us out of our doldrums, and they can cause us to care about making others happy. They share our lives, and they make us feel whole. I'm Scott Simon. Michelle Martin will join you here tomorrow to answer more of your questions from NPR reporters and other experts. You can send them to us at npr.org/nationalconversation. Of course, you can tweet us with the hashtag NPR Conversation. This is the National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.